Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your temporary host for today, Jason Rosenbaum. Chris McDaniel is on assignment. Joining me today is
Joe Manis.
And our very special guest,
Blaine Lutkemer,
a U.S. Congressman from the 3rd District of Missouri. Thank you very much for joining us on this show today. Before we get into kind of your political background and your personal background, tell me a little bit about your district because
it spans a lot of territory.
It's a pretty expansive district from what I know.
Yeah, with redistricting in 2012 as a result of the census, Missouri lost a congressman and we had a lot of significant changes. And so my district now encompasses Lincoln County, most of St. Charles County. Warren Franklin picks up about a third, a half of Jefferson County, and then all the way back to central Missouri, which is Jefferson City, Lake of the Ozarks, as the western edge of it. And that's, in fact, where I live. It basically goes right down the Missouri River, one county wide, and gets to central Missouri and gets a couple counties wide.
Now
it's very lengthy, and obviously, though, the same number of people in the district as all the rest of them. That's constitutionally the way it has to be.
Now, as you just mentioned, you are a resident of St. Elizabeth, which is in Miller County. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why and how you got involved in Missouri politics.
Well, I'd always been involved in a lot of community activities, served on lots of the boards and locally, county, and a couple state board association folks, Missouri Banker Association, what have you, because I'm in the banking business for a while. And I raised a lot of hogs and cattle growing up. Went to college and got a degree, and then came out and was a bank examiner for a couple years. Got in the banking insurance business as well, and waited until my kids were basically out of high school before I got involved in the political world as a state rep. Then we served as the director of tourism for a couple of years, and then after that we were asked to serve in Congress, and here we are.
Why did you get involved in politics? I mean, why did you decide to be a state rep in the beginning? There must have been some issue or something that prompted you to decide you needed to do that.
No, I think it's just a desire to serve the public, and you think you can help make a difference in the lives of people. I'm not a single-issue candidate. I have one burning desire to solve the world's problem on one particular issue because I think anybody that goes into politics with just a single issue that they're trying to change or support or do something with is going to be very disappointed because when they get there, they're going to realize that you've got to be more rounded than that. You have a lot of other issues you're going to have to be able to address. You're going to, constituents, 90% are not going to care about your particular issue. They're going to care about their issues. And so you as a state representative or a senator or a congressman or whatever are going to have to realize that you have to work on all these other issues to be relevant and to be pertinent to be able to do your job. And so when I got there, I was aware that I was going to be more multifaceted and understand a wide variety of issues. But I think that the job is such that you work on all these issues for the betterment of the people you serve and the state that you serve, and now in this situation with the Congress, the nation we serve.
Now, you were involved in one of the more memorable congressional primaries in recent memory. But before we get into that, you actually before then ran for state treasurer in 2004. And the reason I'm mentioning this is not to dredge up bad memories because you did not win that, but a couple of good things came out of that. One, as I was jokingly mentioning before the break, my good friend Tony Luchtenmeyer used some of your signs to win the MSA election. But you are kind of part of this bumper crop of Missouri political figures who lost a statewide election and then later came back and maybe used that experience to win an election a few years later. In your case, it was Congress after losing the state treasurer primary. Claire McCaskill lost the governorship before she won U.S. Senate. Jay Nixon lost a U.S. Senate race a couple times before he became governor. Do you think that race in 2004 kind of helped you maneuver through the zany Mo-9 primary in 2008, or do you think it was other things that kind of got you over the top in that race?
Well, I think it gives you a sense of the level of campaign you have to run to be able to win at the level that we're at. I think also having run statewide, you build a network, and I think even my opponent, whenever we were talking after the race, complimented us and said we'd run one of the finest grassroots campaigns they'd ever seen. And we obviously didn't win, but I think we set the stage for the 08 race whenever we were able to network back with all the different people from all across what turned out to be the 9th district. I also was the 9th congressional district Republican chairman, so I was Kenny's chairman for the entire district. So I had a lot of networking ability. I was a state rep. I'd also been part of the leadership team that helped recruit some of the candidates that won in 03. And as a result, had a lot of name ID, the network built up there that could actually be effective for us. And we built on that when we built our campaign for the 08 congressional race.
Now, let's kind of set the stage, because a lot of our listeners may not know how whirly-burly this primary was. So in 2008, yeah, he's smiling when I say the
now,
word whirly-burly.
Now, first, I want to interject something, yes. Too. The congressman is now one of two members of the Missouri congressional delegation, but he was the first, who went from the State House to the U.S. House. And that's very unusual. I mean, for someone to be a state rep and then go to Congress.
I mean, Sam Graves was in the State House, and so was Lacey Clay, but they were state senators.
Correct.
But yes. So in 2008, Kenny Holsoff decides to run for governor after Matt Blunt decided not to. And that opened up the 9th District, which had previously been a pretty safe Republican seat, but had Democratic history to it. Harold Volkmer was Holsoff's predecessor, and there were Democratic predecessors before then. And in your case, there were four other people in this primary. One was kind of an also-ran opponent named James Beshear, I think, who I never actually met. There was Brock Olivo, the football player, who we all know and love. Danny Moore, a state rep from Fulton. But your main opponent was Bob Onder, who is a state rep from St. Charles, and probably your most serious opponent in that race. And on the other side, you had Judy Baker, state rep, Ken Jacob, a former state senator, Steve Gaw, former Speaker of the House, and Lyndon Bodie, Marion County presiding commissioner. So now that was kind of a verbose explanation
of
what happened.
Right, and the 9th District, which no longer exists, spanned roughly from Columbia all the way up north to the border, took in Hannibal. It was a rather expansive district.
Actually, from Lake the Ozarks
to Lake
St. Louis and all the way to Iowa.
Yeah. Right. So, it's expansive district.
So yeah. That was, out of all your congressional campaigns, that was by far the most active. All your other congressional campaigns, you've either not had Democratic opponents or they've been pretty weak ones. What was it like running in that campaign? And what was it kind of like especially when it got a lot of national attention and national people kind of got involved, both for and against you in that contest?
Obviously, the national attention was something that we couldn't coordinate, so therefore you didn't know whether they were going to come in or not. And so you were hoping that you'd get some help. But we got outspent by $1 million total in the race and still managed to win.
Wow.
But it was the primary was difficult because I knew most of those folks in the primary. They're good friends. And you never want to go run against your friends, but I had some people come to me and say, we've got a lot of good people in the race, Blaine, but I'm not sure they can actually win the general, because you could see a wave coming from the Obama campaign was going to really, there was a lot of negativism toward Republicans as a result of the Bush years, and Obama was a very electric candidate. He really energized the people. And as a result, they were concerned we were going to lose the race, that seat altogether. And so they came and recruited me, and I said yes. And it was a meat grinder. I'm telling you, it was really difficult, because you ran against your friends to win the primary, and then the general. They threw everything at us but the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
We were able to catch a couple of the media folks in Columbia who actually made stuff up. And we challenged them on it, and they had to, go back and have to withdraw some of their comments and admitted that they had done these things. And some of it wound up in a commercial, which they had the commercial eventually pulled. So, and I told my wife and family whenever we were deciding whether to run or not, I asked them, I said, can you really stand what's going to happen in this race? Because I'm a really boring person. My background is pretty vanilla. And I said, so they're going to have to, there's nothing in my background to go after, so they're going to have to find something. And if they can't find anything with their legislative record, they're going to make something up on me. And so that's what they did. And boy, they said, oh, yeah, we can handle it, Dad. Sure, we can handle it. And lo and behold, the first commercial comes out where they make some stuff up. and my daughter and my dad, they went ballistic. They just went nuts. And I said, look, I told you this is going to happen. So we just have to fight back. We have a lot of good people who know me. They know who we are, know what kind of person we are. And we've got to believe that they're going to go out there and tell people this isn't true. What they're saying is they're made up. And so we fought it on two fronts from the standpoint. Our network of friends and supporters fought it on the ground, and we fought it by going back to the people who cut the commercials and made the statements in the paper. Yeah. They were incorrect and got them pulled.
Did you feel like when it became kind of a race where the DCCC got involved and the RNCC got involved, did you feel like you kind of lost control of your campaign? Did it feel like the national people were kind of controlling that campaign, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side? Or did you feel that you still were able to get your message across?
No, we really were still in control of a standpoint that, and I'll give you two quick examples.
Sure.
In the northern half of the district, it was in September, because a little bit before whenever the national folks got in, but we were down 7 points and didn't realize that our opponent had gone up already on the radio. And coming from rural Missouri, I understand that that's a time of year when the farmers are in their combines, combining their wheat and beans, and especially in the northern Missouri. And I said, I know that the important issue in the northern half of my district is guns and babies. And I said, we're going to go up with an ad on guns and babies and stick it on the radio for 3 weeks, see what happens. And so we went from 7 down to 7 up in 3 weeks just by running that ad on gun rights and abortion rights. And, that's an area that, quite frankly, people identify more with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, but they're very conservative up there.
Yeah.
Those are big issues for those people.
So you're saying you were down 7 points in the general or in the primary?
No, in the general.
In the general. So what he's saying in three yeah. weeks, by running a pro-gun anti-abortion ad, you were able to go – change 14 points in 3 weeks.
In three weeks. So, follow up, if I may.
Yes.
To your point, though, the national guys were at, coming probably middle of end of September, first part of October.
Yes.
They started coming in. But what happened, a turning point in the campaign is actually one that we made, I think. In my opponent, we found out they were going to go dark in St. Louis on the broadcast TV. And there's a huge swath in a corner of my district, about 25%, 30% of my district at that time was in the St. Charles, Franklin, Warren, Montgomery area. And they went dark for a week, and I said, all right, this is our chance. And so this is our dagger in the heart. So we went up 1,000 points that week, our own money. It wasn't them, but it was us. Went up 1,000 points for a week. And that was it. That was a dagger in the heart. We won this area by over 15,000.
Yeah. Was there a particular message with those 1,000 points?
No, it was just hammering the message that we'd had the last 3 weeks of the campaign. And so there was no message in particular that we thought would be different than what we had been doing. It's just that because they were not there to answer what we were saying, we were able to go up for a week unchallenged and they just dropped off the map at that point.
And
we went about 15,000 votes up on that end of the district as a result of that.
So the result was that you beat Judy Baker, I believe, by 3 percentage points. And I remember being in Columbia that night when I was actually at the Democratic headquarters, and they were obviously very happy about Obama winning and, Jay Nixon winning and whatnot. But then I could sense there was kind of the enthusiasm kind of got zapped a little bit when they found out that you had won and that Kurt Schaefer had beat Chuck Graham in one of the bigger upsets in Boone County history. And I believe you two were actually having a victory party at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And what did it kind of feel like? It seemed like it was kind of a life-changing experience winning that race and becoming a congressman. What's it kind of been like from that moment up until this point being in Congress?
Well, obviously, it's a great honor to be able to go to Washington and serve our not only our district and our state, but serve the nation. I mean, most of the issues are no longer district specific anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're more state or mostly national in scope. So as a result, you have to look at things just a little bit differently in that regard. But it's just a tremendous amount of work. You have to be the issues are probably tenfold more. In number as well as probably in importance from the standpoint of what you're working on. So it's just a completely different job than being a state rep.
Absolutely.
Or state senator.
I know you're on the Financial Services Committee, but there's a variety of issues that you've been involved in. What do you see as the top two or three issues that you've been involved in since you've been in Congress, the things that really move you and that you've really tried to make a difference?
Well, I think, the financial services stuff obviously is something I have an interest in, a background in. One of the things that we're working on right now is the Common Core stuff. Mm-hmm. In 2011, prior to that, the parent was in charge of the information but of the child at school. And now, as a result of the 2011 law that was part of Common Core, the schools now is in charge of the information with regards to the whether they can be given out or not. And so as a result, that's something we've been working on. We've kind of become the de facto expert on river issues because of I had the Mississippi River all the way from Iowa to St. Louis and had half the Missouri across the state. And so as a result, we had three different core agencies to work with, our regional folks to work with. And now with the new district, I still have two. But, again, the river issues are very, very important, and we work with the Corps a lot and a lot of the stakeholder groups. I am the vice president of the Mississippi River Valley Flood Association, which is a group from St. Louis down to the mouth of the Mississippi, mostly made up of 11 districts and state and local officials. And their goal is to maintain adequate levee funding and flood control to make sure they don't lose the what's behind it. And so we're involved in a myriad of issues. And I you know, you start picking one out, well, pretty soon two or four of those will pop up here, so I can spend the rest of the afternoon talking about it. But it, you know, every issue is important. One of the things that we were able to do is, you know, a lot of people don't realize is we were the ones who led the charge on the child farm labor rule. The Department of Labor tried to issue a rule that said was so restrictive that if you'd had a 14-year-old child that wanted to cut the neighbor's grass with a riding lawnmower, you wouldn't be able to do it because the rule was so restrictive. And so we were able to push back on that and stop that nonsense. And we fought a fiduciary rule proposed by the Department of Labor, which they're going back through right now and trying to reauthorize it again. But we did it about 2 years ago, which would make it so restrictive that you probably wouldn't be able to have IRAs marketed because of the way the fiduciary liability that you would wind up with as a result of this rule. So a lot of things that we do, we push back on a lot of agencies. You know, another thing that to me is really important, nobody ever knows about it, is that we save the Technical Career Center folks in the state of Missouri.
How so?
We're only one of the 50 states that allow for our schools to report on a cash basis, and the federal government on one report wants you to report on an accrual basis. Well, this one report happens to affect our career centers, and they were going to have to spend anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 to get their books fixed up differently. And probably $1,000 to $2,000 per year after that to be able to file this report correctly. And so we had 32 career centers in the state, and a couple of them said, okay, no problem. And a couple other ones said, well, you know, we'll change over the course of time. But you wind up with 25 of them that said, you know what, if we do this, we're going to close our doors because we get so much money from the federal government and we have to file this report and the money stops. We can't afford to do this any longer. So they came to us and said, can you help us? And so we took 14 months to fight the Department of Education. And in doing that, finally they get tired of putting up with us. I mean, I'm an old Dutchman from Central Missouri, hard-headed, and if I get something in my head, I'm just don't give up. I mean, we just don't quit. And so we had them in our office one day, and I told them, I said, look, this is a very, very important issue to the people of my state, to the educational community of my state, and I'm not going to give in on this. You gave this – we have to every year have an exemption to be able to continue to do this, and you've given this for the last 14 years. And so there's no reason to do it now other than just trying to be obstinate about it. There's nothing changed. So we need that exemption for another year, 2 years, or from now on. And so we argued around there and finally just said, they threw their hands up and said, you got it. We're tired of arguing about it. And so as long as our schools now comply with all the other rules and don't get themselves in trouble, they will be able to continue to file a report on a cash basis and saved 25 schools from going out of business. Now, and just to give you an idea how important, one more question, how important career centers are, they educate about 500 nurses a year come out of this. That's how important saving our career centers was. So that's just one field, but they're a very, very important part of our educational system here in the state. And again, I don't serve on a committee that oversees this, but it was something that was brought to me that I thought was so important that we spent our time and energies to do something.
Now, you've also been a pretty outspoken critic of the Affordable Care Act, and you also have been, you know, a major player in some of the pushback between the Republican-led House and the Democratic-led Senate. Do you want to talk a bit about that? I mean, A, your stance as far as how you think the Affordable Care Act may play going into the fall elections and sort of how you see the relationship right now between the House and Senate.
Because it seems like, as we were kind of talking about before, like the House passes a bunch of stuff and goes down this bottomless hole in the Democratic Senate. It doesn't seem like the two are in sync very much. Is that kind of your sense as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're obviously occupied leadership-wise by different parties. So therefore, you automatically have some differences right there. Ideologically, that it's just not working. And you know, right now the Senate is trying to defend all the president's policies, and including the Affordable Health Care Act. And we've sent, I don't know how many, 40-some different bills over there that will repeal, extend, waive, change parts of all of the health care bill. And so we've been supporting those. I really don't think this is the way that we need to fix our health care system. I acknowledge that the health care system had some problems, but I don't think scrapping it and basically, if we remember, this health care law was nothing more than a stopgap measure to get to single payer. That's what this is all about. And the president wanted to go from what we had to a single-payer system, and this is the interim step. And I just don't think that we need to go to a single-payer, and I don't like where we're at with this because I'd rather have the individual and the doctor in charge of your health care rather than the federal government or an insurance company. And this is where the president wants to go, and I just disagree with that philosophically. And I think it bears out that the people are going to have better care. It's going to be cheaper. And you're going to wind up with less cost as a system as a whole if you go this other route. And so our challenge as Republicans is to find an alternative plan to what the president has. And we have a couple different ones out there. What we're probably going to do here in the next couple of months is coalesce behind a single plan. I think there's three right now that our caucus has actually got. But we're going to coalesce behind a single plan and use that as our plan that we want to show as our alternative to the president's plan. And then continue to beat the drum on this, because at the end of the day, this plan, quite frankly, I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet.
Now, the pushback from the Democrats are going to be when you talk about repeal is they point to a bunch of things within the law that are attractive to people, whether it be pre-existing conditions, whether it be
keeping your kids on 26,
or just the general idea that more people may get access to health insurance. I'm sure that's going to be kind of a message from the Democrats, maybe not toward you, as we'll get into in a minute, but toward competitive races. How would you kind of respond to that line of argumentation?
Well, I don't think they've got a leg to stand on when it comes to access to care from the standpoint that Obamacare has already been shown that it's going to dislocate thousands and thousands, millions and millions of people from the standpoint of being able to have care. I mean, the numbers are phenomenal. You're looking at between 2.5 and 3 million people that are going to be without care who had it to begin with.
Now, so, you mean people who were lost?
Who have care now, but will lose it as a result of an employer saying they no longer will provide health care to you, and you can't get care anymore because you don't have enough of a job to pay for it. And I'll give you a quick example. Okay. Got an employer who manages 4 hotels, 800 people, 700 people, 80% of them full time, 20% part time. With the advent of this, and it's going to cost him $1.5 million extra to be able to keep his people fully covered. Well, to get around this, he's just going to drop his numbers down to 80-20 the other way, 80% part-time, 20% full-time. So now you've got 400 people that no longer not only have health care, but they've got a part-time job and can't afford health care. So this is what's happening across the nation. Now, that being said, the president's giving waivers and extensions on some of the different employers, but a lot of this is already in place from the standpoint that the employer had to begin January 1, began to count his people toward next January, being able to qualify or not qualify, be able to find or not find for whether he had a plan or not have a plan. The president still has nothing with individual mandate for those people under that. And so it's and I think the 800-pound gorilla in the room on this is yet to come, which are the Medicare and the Medicaid individuals.
Yeah.
The Medicare folks, basically the doctors usually break even on Medicare, but this plan took $716 billion out of Medicare. And go talk to your doctor and ask him if he's very happy. I was at an event Friday night, and a doctor came up to me and said, "Hey, what's going on? My payments for Medicare are been whacked significantly." I said, "Yeah, they've been whacked significantly. That's because the health care bill took $716 billion out, and you're going to now not get paid at enough to be able to keep these people and break even on them. So now you're going to lose money like they've been losing money on Medicaid individuals." And so not only are the people on Medicare going to wind up with having to pay more, you're going to wind up with fewer doctors wanting to be able to take you. So you're going to lose – there's an access problem. The Medicaid people, a lot of them rushed onto the Medicaid rolls thinking, oh, we'll get on the Medicaid rolls and we'll get our coverage that way. That's fine. The only problem is the doctors lose significant amount of money on that as well, and have already restricted their practices on Medicaid folks, and will restrict it even further as a result of more people on Medicaid. So the people on Medicare and Medicaid, by the end of the summer, they all will have cycled through their doctors two or three times, found out what a bad deal it really is. You talk about a mess. This is a meteorite getting ready to hit our healthcare system and our economy.
But Paul Ryan's budget proposal to balance the budget included the same $700 million cut. So how does the GOP counter that when most of the balanced budget proposals include that same cut or more as far as on the Medicare side? How do you?
On the Medicare side, he at the age 55, you get to choose what you want to do. And as a result, those folks back in those years are able to allow the existing Medicare folks to continue with the existing plan at 55 and under.
But he did keep that cut in, is my point.
It can be done, but you can't do it the way the president's doing it.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm asking. I mean, do you feel like the proposals, the Republican proposals that you'll be coalescing behind – we'll be able to have the savings but a different way.
Yes. Ryan's plan is not part of our health care plan. That's not in what the health care plan will be. None of our health care plans incorporate his plan into them. A lot of them incorporate a couple of things that you said about portability, about pre-existing conditions. There's three or four good things in the health care plan of the president, and that's about it. And we've included three or four of those things. But we've also included things like malpractice reform, tort reform. You've also got pooling in there. You've also got high-risk pools, which health savings accounts. All of these things work, have been proven to save money, give people choices, allow the individual to have responsibility for his own decisions on his own care. And we want to put those things back in there. But healthcare savings are very effective about saving money and giving choice to the individual, and they work. And yet they were something that the president's plan took out. High risk pools are a really good way to actually save money from the standpoint that you put the folks who can't get insurance into this pool. You subsidize those; they're the ones who need the coverage, and it minimizes the increase in cost of insurance on the rest of the folks. It really works. When I was in the State House in Missouri, I worked for a long time on trying to revamp our pool. And, in fact, Missouri was the last high-risk pool in the country to get revamped.
Now, even if the Senate switches to Republican control in the fall, we don't know if it will, but there's predictions that it very, very well may as of 2015, you still would have the president who would veto any of this. So how do you see some of this getting into effect, or is this something that's a fight that you start now knowing that it may be 2017 before you can get anywhere, and that's assuming a Republican gets in the White House?
Well, I think there's two approaches. I think you've just mentioned them both here. I think one is you do your job, which is to find solutions to the problems that we have and put together bills that will address those problems and then drop them on the president's desk, and it's up to him to say yes or no on them. And if he says no, well, then in the next election, we can say, look, we've got plans. We've got solutions. We've already passed them. They're laying on the president's desk that can solve our healthcare situation and change us, put us in a different direction where the patient and doctor's in charge of your care instead of the federal government. And if the president wants to try and salvage something here, because right now, he's having to extend and waive and give exemptions to all sorts of things to be able to keep this thing afloat. It would implode on its own if he wouldn't do that. But by doing what he's doing, he's allowing it to continue for a while. And what he's doing is waiting until after the fall elections, and then he'll make some sort of decision at that time whether he's actually going to scrap it or not. And what he really wants to do, if we would lose the House and Senate both, he would go to a single-payer system with 90 days. I would bet everything that that's what he would do, because that's where he's at.
Now, before we get into your incredible reelection campaign, I do want to talk about wood-burning stoves because – I read an article about this in the Associated Press, and it's become a really big source of controversy. So kind of just explain what I'm babbling about right now.
On wood for heating devices.
Yes.
Okay, the EPA and their infinite wisdom, they are presently in control of the emissions that come from electrical coal-fired plants, and now they want to take those same emission standards and apply them to your wood heating device. Yeah. And Right now, they're going to start with the outdoor wood furnaces, but they're going to go to the other ones on the inside. You can just see it coming. I mean, anybody who knows how this group operates, that's just the next step. And then after that, who knows? They may try to regulate your campfire. Who knows? But, you know, what I've done is take the lead on this issue from the standpoint. We're working with the industry right now to say, hey, where can we go on this? How can
There's a wood heating stove industry?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Continue.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Oh, I'm sure there is. But I mean, if they're making the stoves.
You mean an association, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but continue.
Yeah, there's an association of companies that produce wood heating devices, yes. Whether it's an outdoor wood furnace mm-hmm. or an indoor wood furnace or an indoor wood stove. You have fireplace inserts that mm-hmm. go in that heat, that utilize heat, that have little heating systems. I've got one in my house, matter of fact. And so all these different wood heating devices can be and will be affected at some point if you let EPA continue down this road. And so what we're trying to do is do a little preventative problem here so that we can get keep these folks in business and keep them minimize the cost to mm-hmm. our constituents and allow them continue to burn what is a very cheap fuel. And also, you know, I have to realize that a lot of these folks, by doing what they're doing, they're cleaning up a lot of the woods the trees that are dead that fall down, mm-hmm. and as a result, you manage your forests better. You know, this is one of the things that if you talk to – I'm working on this problem right now, too, with what's going on in the Mark Twain Forest with our forestry folks. I mean, they are because they have mismanaged our forest, there's so much dead stuff on the floor of the forest that they're having to go through with controlled burns. And so as a result of that, they're winding up actually burning some good timber, mm-hmm. which that's a whole other issue. But get back to the wood stoves and wood furnaces. This is a basic way of heating your home. They're built with safety standards, and now we have to put emission standards, which could be very, very expensive and make these things to the point where they may not be affordable for some folks. So we're fighting that issue as well.
Do you think you'll be successful?
I think we will. I think at some point we're going to get a lot of folks to support this. This is madness what these people are doing. This is similar to what happened with the water issue out in the far west, out in California, where because of an endangered fish, they wound up flooding a river with all their drinking water and water going to be used for their city. And now they don't have any water, and the cities are going to go dry. And so we passed a bill the other day. I think this is a similar issue. We can just say, hey, look, this is how – this goes back to the basic way we used to heat in our homes and for – since we were the pilgrims came over here and helped, built our first log cabins, we've been building fires in our homes. This is silly.
Yeah.
Now, with all this, there's been speculation, particularly the last couple of years and more recently last few months, on whether or not you plan on staying in the House, or there's been a lot of Republicans who've been encouraging you to look at running for governor in 2016, or there'll be Senate contests against Claire McCaskill in 2018. What's your thoughts as far as your own political future? You're not that old. What's your?
That depends. What are you?
Well, let's put it this way: you're a few months younger than me.
Okay,
but do you have any desire to run statewide in the next couple of years?
You know, I really was not looking to run for this position, and they came knocking on my door. And so I have a race here this fall that we're focused on. And so we're going to focus on that one. And if things open up down the road for something else, we take a look at it. But I'm not going to at this point, I like what I'm doing. We're happy where we're at. We've got a race we've got to focus on here this fall. And after that, who knows?
Now, before we get back, let's talk about this race for a second. Because as many people who follow Missouri politics know, the congressional elections here are not usually that exciting anymore. Many of the districts are pretty safe for either Republicans or Democrats, and usually we don't give them a second thought. But in your case, we're making an exception, mainly because of the people who have filed against you in both the Republican and the Democratic primary. In this instance, Leonard Steinman, who is somehow of a meme in Missouri politics for his Santa Claus-like beard and his propensity to run in pretty much every race known to man, has filed against you in the Republican primary. Normally, that wouldn't be a big deal. Leonard Steinman running against you is kind of like the wind blowing in the fall. You know, it happens. But his wife, Velma Steinman, has filed to run as a Democrat. There was even a huge article about this in the Jefferson City newspaper of a Steinman versus Steinman matchup, potentially, if Leonard Steinman somehow manages to beat an incumbent congressman by spending no money. So with that humorous explanation aside, what do you make of this zany situation? And do you think that there could be national attention on this race simply because two people who are married each other are running against each other in your district?
Well, actually, they're running against him.
Running against you, basically. Right.
Well, you know, obviously it's the way our election laws are. For $100, you can walk into the Secretary of State's office, sign your name on the line, and you can run. And so they've chosen to do that. There's another individual in the race, so right. I do. And we've got till next Tuesday before the filing deadline is over with, and so we may get some more folks there. So, you know, I can't focus on those folks. I've got to continue to focus on my race and on what we're doing in D.C. and the constituent services we try to provide, and that's where we're at.
Would you participate in a debate that features all the candidates, including both Steinmetz?
I'm not sure how that would be structured.
I mean, it could be similar to the debate at Truman State a few years ago. I mean, maybe they could ask who their favorite founding fathers were or something like that. For Mo 9 people, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay.
You know exactly. But kind of going back to what Joe was talking about before, you know, I mean, 2016 is going to be a big year for Republicans in the state. We had Catherine Hanaway on last week who's running for governor. Who knows? Maybe you'll be in that gubernatorial contest. People have to learn how to spell your name. Lutkemeyer. Did that with no paper, by the way. What do you see the prospects for the Republicans in 2016, and do you see yourself as a part of that?
Well, I think we'll be a part of it from the standpoint that, you know, I still enjoy the job. And as long as my health is good, I would anticipate I'd be running again. And we're going to continue to help whoever the ticket is. You know, I have been, if you've listened to me or been around me very much or heard me speak very much, you know that I continually talk about one of the problems that we have as a party is that we're divided. And that right now is an opportunity for us as a party to win a lot of statewide as well as national races as long as we stay unified. And so I continue to preach this message of unity from the standpoint that I believe that our country is in danger. I see this president taking us down a road that we don't need to go down and endangering our future. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is a very impactful time. And if we as Republicans stand and on the sidelines and nip at each other's heels instead of uniting and trying to elect candidates, whoever a candidate is, I think we have nobody to blame but ourselves if we lose our country. So I am, you know, continually talking with lots of different candidates and lots of different folks trying to get everybody to continue to support our ticket. I think we, as Republicans, represent the ideals and principles that most people espouse and believe in. I think we represent the ethics of the country and how our country was founded. And I think our set of principles and values are easy to sell because they resonate with the general public and the voting folks. And we just have to do a better job of messaging. We as Republicans are lousy at messaging. And we've got to do a better job of that. And I think we can do that if we can articulate a message, for instance, on the health care bill where we have an alternative. Say, look, this is not the way you want to go. We want to go back to a patient-centered, doctor-centered system of health care. That will resonate with the people if you've got a plan that works. Why? Yeah. So I think we'll be engaged and involved, and we're going to continue to be as much as we can. I also like to support my local state rep, state senate candidates. You know, it's important to support all those folks as well.
One quick question before we go. Are you going to get involved in the 2nd District senatorial race? Could we see you endorse Bob Onder potentially?
Well, I will be more than happy to support, and we're going to work for the candidate who comes out of that race.
Oh.
But we're not going to get in the middle of a primary.
That would have made awesome imagery if you got behind your former opponent. But you're going to have to fight it out in that. But anyways, I'm getting the sense that we're out of time here. So I want to thank you very much for coming in today. It was a blast from the past and the present. So to close us out, you can find all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow Joe at
Jay Manis. That's J-M-A-N-N-I-E-S.
And you're actually one of the last Missouri congressmen to join Twitter. You're at Blaine Press, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. That's correct.
And congratulations on that, by the way. And thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Until next week, so long.
So long.